This is Popular Front, a podcast focused on the niche details of modern warfare and underreported conflict with me, Jake Hanrahan. Today we're speaking to researcher and writer Alexander McKeever. He's going to be talking to us about why Turkey has started bombing northeastern Syria, or Rojava, the Kurdish areas, right after a very suspicious quote-unquote Kurdish terrorist attack inside Istanbul that happened on November 13th. Turkey is blaming the YPG, the Kurdish militia that runs Rojava. None of it really adds up. Alexander is going to talk to us about the damage and effect these airstrikes have had on the Kurds in Rojava. If you like what we're doing, support us at patreon.com/popularfront. For what, the last, like, it's almost 2 months now, I believe, right? Turkey has decided to start bombing Rojava, the Kurdish areas of northeastern Syria. Well, I'll let you explain it. Why are they doing it again for like the 100th time? Why are they bombing the Kurds in northeastern Syria again?
So it all really began with the bombing in Istanbul on November 13th. This was a terrorist attack carried out, killed six people, targeting like a busy pedestrian boulevard. Turkey immediately used this as or immediately blamed the YPG as the culprits of the attack, and used this essentially as an excuse to launch a new operation across northern Syria. And of course, so Turkey has not really put forth any information regarding the links that would prove that the YPG is related to the attack. And of course, the YPG and the PKK and everyone has denied the attack, so the evidence is really quite weak. So several days after this occurred, these airstrikes across all of northeastern Syria and even some of the west that's controlled by the SDF began. And these began on November 20th, and really quite intense. Turkey's been bombing parts of northern Syria on and off for years now, and over the last year or so, it's been carrying out a drone assassination campaign, largely targeting members of the SDF, commanders, and some lower-ranking fighters, as well as some civilian politicians and activists. But this was a clear escalation that began the night of the 19th, and again, hit targets from all the way on the border with Iraq, through Hasaka, Raqqa, and then into Minbij and Tell Rifat. So it was really quite unprecedented, just the breadth of the targets hit.
Right, let's talk a little bit about that attack that you mentioned there at the start. So in Istanbul, as you mentioned, there was this, it wasn't a suicide bomb, and I think at first they said it was, and then they decided it wasn't, and then they arrested this young woman and allegedly said that she was the one that set the bomb off. There's been so many different recurring stories from the government itself. Even like actual Turkish politicians have said like, what? Like, what the fuck is happening here? It's very close to the elections as well, so a very interesting timing. And it's actually identical to what happened last time these elections were in place. The bomb went off in almost the exact same fucking place. That was blamed on TAK or TAKA, kind of, offshoot of the PKK. This time they're blaming this young woman, right? What evidence is the Turkish state putting forward to blame the YPG for this?
So they've come up with this whole story that she crossed the border pretty soon before the attack, and that she had some sort of handler in Kobani that was like, an SDF commander who'd instructed her on how to carry out the attack. But to be honest, the Turkish side of things, I know that there hasn't been very conclusive evidence. There's been basically no evidence. There's been a lot of allegations. But I haven't followed the Turkish side of things particularly closely. I know that the SDF and the commander-in-chief of the SDF, Mazlum Abdi, has said that the woman comes from a family who several of her brothers were members of the Islamic State, as well as Nusra and other factions. Again, I don't know how true this is. I don't know if the SDF has actually published any information regarding this. And then a little bit after the attack, maybe a week or two, the Turkish state published a YPG identification portrait of a man saying that he was involved in the attack as well. They gave a name for this supposed individual. The picture, I mean, it looked like, you know, you could easily just put this together, take someone's face, and then put it in front of a YPG. It's like one of those, looks like one of the like Shahid, the martyr placards.
Yeah.
But this was denied by the SDF as well. Again, this they didn't include any information. So these some people were saying, oh, this can't be real. They only do this for martyrdom. These sort of portraits are only for martyrdom announcements, which I did find examples of certain ID cards that were linked to various military academies, like, you know, the various YPG military academies over the years where they have this kind of thing. But those ID cards list all of this other information, like the name, their code name or whatever, their date of birth, place of birth, etc., and the name of the military academy. So if this was like a real ID card that they found, you'd think that they'd put all this information out there because it would only make their potential case stronger. But they just put the picture out there. So
yeah, it's weird. I mean, considering this almost exact same attack happened last time the elections were on for the current government in Turkey, you'd have thought that if the attackers were going to do it again at the exact same time, at the same place, almost having not done it since the last election, they would have learned at least not to bring the fucking ID card along, but apparently not. It stinks, man. To me, it doesn't even seem like I'd be surprised if AKP even planned this. It seems way too amateur. I heard a theory from a Turkish friend of mine that perhaps like one of the other politician, you know, political groups kind of planned it that way to maybe, you know, make things look insecure in the country, blah, blah, blah. But who knows? So they launched these attacks, and within the first like round of attacks, of course, as it always is, a load of civilians started getting killed, right? Derek and therefore and around there.
Yeah, so the main airstrike that resulted in civilian casualties in the first night hit a power plant. It's a relatively small facility in a town called Tekel Bekel in Derek in the northeastern corner of Syria. And this was reportedly a double tap strike where they hit the power plant initially, and then the local civilians as well as security forces, and I've read that actually coalition forces were there as well at one point. They all sort of collected at the site and were investigating, looking at what happened. And then several hours later, it was hit again while there were still civilians assembled there. And so this killed, I believe it was 11, maybe plus minus one or two, or plus minus one. Majority of them were civilians. One was apparently a former YPJ commander, but I mean, it seems like she was there in a civilian capacity. There was also a Hawar news reporter who was one of the individuals killed in the strike as well.
Yeah, a journalist. He was friends with a friend of mine. Very sad situation. Where else have they been hitting? You mentioned earlier that they've been like kind of hitting airstrikes in areas where they don't normally do it. Particularly, I found interesting that they started peppering Kobani. And I thought, well, like you said, you know, the coalition there, like a load of US soldiers are there, there's a ton of bases there. I very much doubt that they're allowed to airstrike anywhere where the US are without the US knowing first. What do you think was going on there?
Well, it was what was particularly interesting was the strike on the joint coalition SDF base, which is actually, it's in western Hasaka, western Jezira Canton, really sort of in between Tel Tamer and Hasaka City. But this was a joint coalition base where they, you know, could carry out training missions with the SDF, with the YET, the anti-terror units. Mm-hmm. And also it's, I mean, El Monitor's reported on this relatively extensively. It's a major headquarters for Muslim Abdi and for the SDF, like general command in general, and where they carry out press conferences and meet with US diplomats. And so this was, I mean, I don't know the exact layout of the base, and I don't actually know where it was struck in these attacks that happened, I believe it was on the 20th or the 21st of November. So, I mean, it could be that it was at like a somewhat significant distance from wherever U.S. personnel were. But still, I mean, it sends a message that Turkey's willing to push the boundaries and see how far they can go. The other interesting attack was airstrike was around Al Hol camp, which, you know, contains tens of thousands of women and children that, you know, women that were wives. I mean, some of them members of the Islamic State, essentially, and the children of these women and fighters. And so there's an airstrike that struck a security facility somewhere nearby. It's a little hazy. I don't think it was actually in the camp itself, but it was maybe a kilometer or two nearby, and it was a base for the security forces in charge of the camp. It was I think the commando forces, one of these SDF sort of subunits. And that strike killed 8 individuals that are responsible for the camp. And, you know, this is quite far from the Turkish border. El Hol is like on the Iraqi border, and I don't know, maybe 40, 50 kilometers away from the Turkish border.
A lot of the Kurdish people I spoke to in Rojava at the time were sure, like, okay, this time they're going to invade us. Turkey was talking about a possible ground invasion, and then it kind of just didn't happen. What do you think happened there?
So I think there's a couple factors to consider. I think on the Turkish side, I mean, as you brought up, it's election season. So this entire thing, this entire escalation, is you can't really separate it from Erdogan's campaign right now. And if you look at the previous operations, whether it's, you know, the invasion of Afrin in 2018 or the in northeast Syria in 2019, he gains a significant bump in popularity and in polling for these. So I think it's pretty clear that it's a pretty easy calculus that if you escalate in Syria, it will help him domestically. But I do think that, you know, he was still being a little bit cautious, obviously, because they didn't actually invade. And an invasion across the entire border could be costly. So I think that it was easy to escalate all these airstrikes everywhere. And they also gave this air campaign an operation name, which they hadn't done in the past. It was like, I don't know, Claw Sword or something. So I think that helped with maybe domestic propaganda to make it seem like an actual operation, maybe in comparison with, you know, Euphrates Shield, Olive Branch, Peace Spring, these previous operations within Syria. But then I think also you have to look at the American and the Russian response to all this, which neither of them were willing to give Turkey the green light for these operations. Obviously, both have military deployed in these areas, Russians more to the west, Americans more to the east. So it's not like 2019 where you had Trump, who's obviously his decision making was largely based on ego and immediate gratification. So it was very easy.
How he felt that morning, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So that was very easy for Erdogan to get Trump to withdraw forces. That's not the case with the Biden administration. While they are not 100% invested, they are not willing to let Turkey just take over all of northeastern Syria. And, you know, the same goes with the Russians, whereas the Russians are sort of balancing a lot of different things. They have their relationship with the SDF. They're obviously the main supporter, the main sponsor of the Syrian regime. And then they, you know, Putin and Erdogan have this interesting transactional relationship So, I mean, the Russians did seem a little bit amenable to allowing Turkish military to enter certain areas, but ultimately, where we are now, I mean, you know, things are still a little bit up in the air. They were able to put a pause on any further escalation, any potential ground operation.
So where is it at now? Like, what's the situation? I think not that long ago, there was a recent round of airstrikes, but it's calmed down a little bit, right?
Yeah, I think since the first initial barrage, the first couple of days, it's definitely calmed down a bit. I mean, I've been tracking casualties. You know, SDF announced fighters killed, etc. And the vast majority of them occurred within the first 3 days, as well as a lot of regime soldiers were actually killed as well across the border. Yeah, so after the initial barrage that began on the night of the 19th to the 20th, things have definitely calmed down a lot in terms of Turkish airstrikes. The vast majority of the casualties that the SDF and various affiliated, you know, militias, etc., have announced, they almost all of them occurred within perhaps the first 5 days of this round of airstrikes, and really in the last 2 weeks, there's been, you know, limited drone strikes and shelling that's sort of carried out at low intensity on various fronts. But yeah, overall, definitely seen a downturn since mid to late November. And this has also come sort of in coordination with increased diplomacy between Russia and Turkey in particular. There's been various meetings and phone calls between Turkish and Russian officials, and as well as Erdogan Putin, about, you know, how they'll potentially move forward from here. As well, there's also reports that the U.S. had somehow convinced Turkey to not carry out any potential operations in Kobani or Minbij, and instead focus on Tel Rifat. Of course, with reporting on these sort of diplomatic back channel or closed door meetings, it's kind of hard to tell what is real and you know, what's just rumors. Mm. But that's sort of where we are now. You know, this also ties into potential reestablishing of relations between Turkey and Syria. This has been reported. Sort of this process has been ongoing for, you know, about 6 months now. There are rumors that Turkey will reconcile with the Syrian regime and that Erdogan will possibly meet with Bashar al-Assad. And so this is Turkey's using this escalation as leverage to within these talks, because while these talks have gone on, there's still a lot of issues between the two parties, and it's still a long way off before any of these are settled. But Turkey's showing the sort of, you know, belligerence or aggression is just another part of this.
I mean, I can see it happening, to be honest. And I think the Kurds are in a very precarious place right now. You've got Turkey, who is, you know, Erdogan's been openly canoodling with Putin for a long time now, not just buying rocket systems, but even at one of these fucking summits recently, he's just hanging out, like, you know, his best pals with Putin and whatever. And then, you know, at the same time, he's selling all this weapons to Ukraine. So obviously that makes America happy. But then if he can reconcile things with Assad, Russia's going to be happier. And it's like, well, you know, they're somehow the only country that seems to be allowed to, like, you know, have a foot in both camps. But ultimately, you know, each time the Kurds seem to be getting smashed. I feel like ultimately his goal is to get the full-on go-ahead from, you know, both sides to kind of try and wipe out Rojava. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that's over the top or what?
I mean, I think that's one potential outcome or end goal that they envision. But I think way easier would be to force some reconciliation or some sort of deal between Damascus and the autonomous administration where basically the SDF would cease to exist and any sort of Kurdish autonomy would cease to exist. So this, and then basically it would mean Damascus returns to the borders and this entire issue over what they perceive as an issue would disappear. So I think, you know, there's several different outcomes that they might be seeking that might equally be acceptable to them. The end goal is really just the disappearance of the autonomous administration, the SDF.
Yeah, I mean, even so, if they did that, it would still essentially be them trying to wipe out the SDF. But there's no way, like, I mean, the regime military is a fucking joke. Like, there's no other way it could do it without the help of Russia or Turkey stepping in. You see what I mean? Like, it seems like inevitably that would have to happen at some point, I feel.
Yeah, but I think, so right now, and over the past couple, like past year or so, with the drone campaign, and now with this escalation that has, in particular, targeted oil infrastructure, which is sort of the lifeline of the autonomous administration, being able to extract oil and to sell it basically to the Syrian regime as well as the Syrian opposition. That's like a major revenue stream for the autonomous administration and the SDF. So taking out the oil, as well as like just these constant attacks, targeting whatever military, sometimes targeting civilian houses, whatever. There's just this ratcheting up this pressure on the autonomous administration. I think they hope that it can either collapse under this pressure and the other pressure it's facing with like, you know, closed borders with Iraqi Kurdistan and as well as the just devastating economic situation across all of Syria. And then I think they're also banking on the U.S. not staying forever. And that once they put this significant pressure on the autonomous administration and there's a potential American withdrawal in the future, that the SDF, the autonomous administration, would have no choice but to turn to Assad. And, you know, in the end, they wouldn't be able to really bargain with Damascus because they'd have no leverage and they'd be in such a dire situation.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's like every time, you know, when Trump was like, okay, see you later, bye. And obviously they're like, okay, we need to make a deal with Assad. It's like, well, there's no other choice, you know? And like you said, that is no real, you don't really have anything to bargain with in that, you know, in that situation, especially if like America leaves. I don't know, it's bad for them all around. Am I right in saying, I swear I remember they bombed actually inside Iraqi Kurdistan as well in this recent round of airstrikes?
Yeah, I think the Operation Sword, Claw Sword, whatever it's called, this included strikes within both Syria and Iraq. I don't really follow the stuff in Iraqi Kurdistan, the war with the PKK up in the mountains. I assume it was just sort of an escalation of the air campaign there, like a brief uptick. But yeah, it was like a across multiple borders operation.
Yeah, I forget the name. There's the area is, it's a refugee camp, but there's also a, PKK base there. So it's kind of...
It's called like Mahmoor.
Yeah, Mahmoor, that's it. Yeah, and then the Kurds call it Maxmoor. Yeah, like that. I mean, you know, it is a refugee camp in a way, but there's also a PKK base there at the same time. So, you know, it's one of them ones. But yeah, I think they bombed around there. Tell us about what you're doing. You've been tracking very closely the kind of ongoing situation in Rojava, northeastern Syria, the autonomous administration of northeastern Syria, whatever name people want to call it. You've been tracking it very closely. Tell us about your work on that.
Yeah, so earlier this year, starting in, I believe, July, I started doing a weekly newsletter on Substack where I highlight key events occurring both within SDF, you know, Rojava, autonomous administration, yeah, whatever you want to call it, as well as within the Turkish and SNA, Syrian National Army, controlled areas in northern Aleppo and also in the northeast. So basically, I highlight, you know, all the whatever events I think are the most important in a given week. And I pick, you know, about 7 to 10 of them, write a couple sentences about them, try to pull together whatever sources are important for the story, maybe some images, potentially geolocations. And then also I'll do some, you know, sort of random stuff at the end. Sometimes it's like historical images I've seen from Syria, or someone's published a report or something. Maybe I'll highlight that. So yeah, it's been a weekly newsletter, basically. You can subscribe via email. And then additionally, I've been like putting out some other content. Like for example, with this uptick, I was covering it's died down a bit, but the announced casualties from all various parties involved. And then, so sometimes I'll publish essays on a given topic. I did one recently on, there was this episode, you know, where the HTS, Tahrir al-Sham, invaded Afrin with the assistance of some of the SNA factions against other SNA factions.
So for anyone that doesn't know what that means, because it is always alphabet soup. So Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, a very hardline jihadist group, invaded Afrin, which is under the occupation of a mix of bandit, mercenary and jihadist groups that are loyal to Turkey. And then there's ongoing fighting between them, right?
Yeah, essentially. It's the former Nusra group that controls Idlib. And yeah, basically, it just comes down to power politics between these armed opposition groups.
Where can people read your work on that? Where can they go and see this newsletter?
So this is on akmckeever.substack.com. It's MCKEEVER. And then also I'm active on Twitter, at akmckeever.
All right, bro. What's the most interesting thing you think that's happening right now, though, in these areas you cover that people are not aware about?
Personally, I'm always interested in these like SNA disputes and sort of like this thing with HTS and Afrin, just because these groups are, it's so chaotic, the structure of these groups. They're Turkish proxy forces, but Turkey basically didn't want to commit the resources to create like a unified structure. So they've taken all these various warlords and put them together within one structure. And then they all just compete for resources, very sort of predatory on the local economy and civilian life. And it's just constant drama and, you know, alliances and breaking up alliances. So that's one thing. I'd say some other stuff that I have coming out soon with an organization I work part-time with, Syrians for Truth and Justice, STJ, is we've been looking at there's been significant deforestation within Afrin. Afrin was actually outside of like the Syrian coast, like Latakia and Tartus, one of the more forested parts of Syria. A lot of it wasn't necessarily natural. Some of it was, reforestation. But it was, well, this is actual forest too. It's covered in olive trees, but these are like actually forested areas, like pine trees. But since 2018, since the Turkish invasion, large portions of these have just disappeared. This occurs partially because there's been an influx of IDPs and there's a fuel crisis, the fuel shortage across Syria. So people turn to the trees, cut them down for firewood, for heat. But then it's also become a major source of revenue for various SNA factions, where they basically, their fighters cut down entire forests and then resell the wood as firewood or produce charcoal with it. So this has had a devastating effect on the landscape of Afrin.
All right, man. I look forward to reading that. If people want to get hold of you, where can they do that?
Yeah, as I said earlier, on either Twitter or on Substack, or if you want to, you can email me. It's akmckeever@gmail.com.
All right, mate. Thanks very much. Appreciate that.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was researcher and writer Alexander McKeever talking to us about the continued Turkish airstrikes on Rojava, which are ostensibly a response to the attack that we spoke about in Istanbul, the attack that the Turkish state says was led by the YPG, with very little evidence, and the timing of it being around the elections is very iffy, it's fishy. But anyway, If you like what we're doing here at Popular Front, please do consider supporting us at patreon.com/popularfront. As of next year, we'll be putting more of the podcast episodes, probably making them Patreon only, because, well, the kind of techno dystopia hell that the people at YouTube have created for us is the reason. So we could have made, you know, decent money back onto, you know, and put it back into the business had YouTube not fucked with us. Basically, as it stands now, all our new documentaries get age restricted. The whole channel is demonetized anyway, so we can't make a penny from YouTube. Bearing in mind, you know, one of our documentaries has 2.6 million views. Obviously that's made money for YouTube, but nothing for us, so that's how it is. So we can't make any money off of YouTube, and they've started age restricting our stuff as well. So once it's age restricted, you know, it falls off the algorithm, it goes ghost, it's very hard to see, you get very little views, which is a problem, because before they did that to us, it kind of didn't matter so much that we were demonetized, because eventually it would kind of level out, you know, like, not really, but, you know, you would at least get enough attention on the doc that people would usually kind of come over to the Patreon. But that's just, you know, YouTube has decided to just really throttle us. We did have a guy that was from YouTube that was meant to be helping us, but he kind of just stopped. I don't know, he just fell off the face of the earth. So that's great, but that's how it is. So yeah, so going forward, I think there's going to be a lot more content on the Patreon next year. Patreon.com/popularfront. We're going to have to take on more sponsors as well, because, you know, I've been working like almost 7 days a week every day for 4 years on this, 5 years next year. I'm not seeing it fall apart, because we can't make enough money, because YouTube, you know, scumbags were like, oh no, it wasn't advertiser friendly, so fuck them, we'll find a way. But anyway, if you want to support us, if you're a rich Bitcoin guy or whatever, hit us up or go to popularfront.co/support. There's plenty of ways to do it. Thank you very much to our current sponsors. They are Grindcore House, a set of coffee shops in California. One in South, one in West. You can go and check them out at Grindcore House on social medias. Find out. Go there, tell them we sent you. You might get a free coffee. Also sponsored by Oracle Coffee Shop in Portland, Oregon. Again, go there, tell them we sent you. You get a free coffee. I think it's like, I don't know. I think you just literally got to go in and say, yeah, I came because of Popular Front, and they'll give you a free coffee. But you can't do that every time. You can't go in there every day and do that. But, you know, I think you can do that like once. Maybe if you're sneaky, you maybe do it once or twice. But yeah, that's how that is. Also sponsored by Propagandopolis, an outlet selling and reporting on wartime propaganda throughout the history. Go to propagandopolis.com, use the promo code PopularFront10, you get 10% off of your order. If you want to follow us on social media, Instagram is instagram.com/popular.front, Twitter at popularfront_, youtube.com/popularfront, and what else? TikTok, there's TikTok at popular.front. If you want to follow me on anything, it's at Jake_Hanrahan, HANRAHAN. If you want to talk about big time money drops on Popular Front, go to my site, jakehanrahan.com. You'll see how to contact me there. And if you just want to see how links to everything, basically, just go to popularfront.cc. That's links to everything, or the kind of, you know, the landing page, the website is at popularfront.co. Also, you can buy our merchandise at popularfront.shop. We've got plenty of stuff on there. Very soon, we got a new drop coming. It's Camo Champion Windbreaker. So that's going to be a nice one there, popularfront.shop. If you have not received the third issue of the zine yet and you bought it, bear in mind there is serious postal strikes in the UK where I sent all of those zines from. I sent them like well over a month ago now, and a lad in Germany, literally a friend of mine, he got his yesterday. So that's like 6 weeks it almost took for a magazine that fits for your letterbox, an A4 magazine, to get from England to Germany. It took like 6 weeks. That's the state of the UK right now. I don't think people fully understand how unbelievably fucked the country is right now, but it's very badly fucked. But it is coming. Trust me, they are coming. And if there's been some weird error where, I don't know, it must have been the printing of the labels, but some people that ordered like three only got one. If that happened, email me and I will send you out the others. We've done that a few times already, but generally it seems to have gone pretty well, so I'm glad about that. Music in this episode, the intro was by Home and the outro was by Sam Black. You can hear his music at samblackpf.com or look him up, Sam Black PF on Spotify. I do keep meaning to put more of his music on the Spotify, but it's a small team and there's 101 things to do every single day. Anyway, thank you very much to the high tier Patreons. They are Margosha, Rohan Irvine, Ryan Barbadillo, VS, Brian R, Evan Pank, Bradley Hope, Wizard Actual, Claire Hofbauer, Benjamin Topper, Chongus Bongwater, Elijah Finley, Siddhartha O, Damien, Cameron Collins, Q Loves Cape Farts, Nicholas Blomberg, Matthew Diffley, Claire, Liana, Robert, Sean, Christianovich, NTHG, Arturo, Rafael Macias, Ethan Zwick. Thank you, Mo. Such, you are now, alright, a policy wonk, Wallacey, alright, Elise Middlefart, David McManus, Tom Petrie, James Leons, Bradley Davies. I don't really go for these, like, if you put a comedy name on, it's got to be funny, man, come on, Bradley Davies, No Dogs, No Hamsters, Brennan Crave, B, Drift, RX, Tiki Lover, Ben Marshall, Dallas Don, Shikhar Gupta, LD50, Seattle, The Band, K Glitter Vulcan, Bethany Swoveland, Adam H, Derivative Fool, Bottle of Water, Larson8669, Bjorn Kirsten, DS, Michael O'Connor, Disgrunt, Jack Doherty, Nicholas Butter, JD, Jav, Ian Froese, James Cully, Tynan Daly, Ethan, Shanklin the Painter, Fitz Madrid, Ed Coulthard, D San, Mike Barone, Mike, keep me up about the coffee, Ben, Liam Williams, Propaganda, very clever, Chris Cusimano, DZA, Georgia Arani, DR, Amy R, Rubicon, Frank Austin, Amelia Mee, excuse me, Christina Rovetti, so fucking ill, Freya Northman, Niba, Noah, Andrew Hurley, Vida Provost, Brian McLaughlin, Tom Lochrin, Young Wasabi, Tony Bin, JL, Stephen Davila, Dan Dunham, Chad Walker, Lawrence Abrahams, Peter McCormick from What Bitcoin Did, Christopher Martin and Ryan Sandercock. Thank you all so much for your help. I really do appreciate the support. Support us, patreon.com/popularfront.